So when I say, what is Irgun Kodesh? Why do we have Irgun Kodesh? Why do we have Holy Assembly, these two places? What is the testimony of the Lord in this? That's what I want to speak to today. And again, McCann speaks at Irgun Kodesh or Holy Assembly here without speaking about my dad, but I'm going to try to focus on what I think the Lord has done a little bit through my lens. My dad's got a great perspective. Without my dad, we wouldn't be here. He's the founding emeritus rabbi of Beth Messiah. And he has gone to a messianic shul, he graduated from a messianic university program to be rabbi. I did the same thing. So we have parallel stories, but he really has a great resume, so to speak. He's been through a lot of life stuff. Again, that you have to ask him for the details. I'm sorry, I'm parched. All right, so here's the story. In order to explain why we have Irgun Kodesh today, and again, a lot of this is just testimony, but in order to explain why we have it today, I have to tell you why we split up. Because originally, the community of faith, the community behind the Messiah, was only Jewish. There was no church aspect to it at all. Yeshua came, he's a Jew, his ministry was to Jews, a couple exceptions, a Samaritan woman, and you know, a couple exceptions. But it was almost, he was just a Jewish man living in a Jewish city, speaking to Jewish people about Jewish things. And they understood that he was going to do this. It was all prophesied. So what happened? Why did we go from that to what's in the world today? You know, how did the separation come? I think there's three reasons for it, and I won't go heavy into them. One, there's a spiritual aspect. It says in the scriptures itself that there would be a spiritual aspect. There is a spiritual aspect. So that's one reason, and I won't go much into that. The problems that we have, the separation that we have today, there's a spiritual aspect to it. That's a big deal. The second reason is the politics of the day. I also won't speak much to this. It's straight history from about 67 or so AD. Once Yeshua ascended and he rose and he went back into heaven, and he said to his Talmudim, to his disciples, he said, "You go in Jerusalem and I'll empower you with the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, so you will be my witnesses across the world." It was a big deal. It was a very special moment, and the community of believers grew. Jerusalem and other parts of the world, it was Jews and Gentiles. It was a very cool thing. The community was growing. Well, in Jerusalem, predominantly a Jewish city, there was the Romans controlled the city, and the Jews in Jerusalem at the time they were tired of being oppressed by Roman oppression and Roman rules and Roman laws. They were tired of it. So they decided to have a revolt, and they planned and planned and planned, when should we have this revolt? And eventually around 67, 68, they started the revolt. The one group, historians believe, that didn't join the revolt were the Messianics. Messianic Jews. Now, there's a debate on how many Messianics there were in Jerusalem at the time. Some say 15% of all Jews in Jerusalem at the time, historically speaking, 15% of Jews in Jerusalem at the time were Messianics. Some say 30% of Jerusalem Jews at the time were Messianic. I believe it was on the higher side. Not because I'm optimistic, but because most historians believe it's on the higher side, the 30% side, not the 15% side. So it was a significant number of Messianics, Messiah-believing, Messiah-following Jews in Jerusalem around 67, 68 AD, when the revolt starts. When it really kicks off, when they try to shake Rome off their backs, the Messianics didn't want to fight. And there's a bunch of reasons, and we don't have any hard evidence as to why, but we believe the Messianics didn't want to fight based on what the historians have found. So the ones who fought, how do you think they looked at that? Not so well, right? The scattering occurred. The Lord said there would be a scattering. In 70 AD, the Romans came in and they squanched Jerusalem. They knocked over the walls, tore down the temple, and they scattered. The Lord himself had prophesied, had said through prophecy hundreds of years earlier that the great diaspora would occur. And to all corners of the world, Jews would be scattered to all corners of the world. And were they ever? When the Romans came in, they killed, they did terrible things, and then the ones who could survive and who could flee did, and they fled everywhere. But there's now a political separation between some of the Messianics and some of the other non-Messianics that were in Jerusalem at the time. Other things also started to occur. The Pharisees and Sadducees were duking it out. They're not Messianic, they're not Messiah-following Jews, but they're really duking it out. Politically, who's going to get the power? There was a massive power vacuum once the temple went down. The priests, the Levites, drove a lot of the duties at the time, and the teachers were always jockeying for power. They put together something, the Sanhedrin, and that would be a place that they would jointly kind of lead the religious aspects of what was going on in Jerusalem at the time. Sanhedrin was made up of Pharisees and Sadducees, and we knew some Levites that had some connection to it as well. When Jerusalem fell, the temple fell, the Sadducees fell, and there was nobody to stop the Pharisees and their power. You tracking with me? So they started to move. When the scattering occurred, poof, the only group that had any real say in the scattering were the Pharisees, who later became the rabbis. That was the group that pulled together the Talmud. The Messianic Jews, the Messiah-believing Jews, never went away. They also scattered all over the world. And the Messianic belief went with them all over the world. Gentiles were now really cooking all over the world. And so that was the political separation. And then there's the religious separation. I suppose it kind of bumps into the politics of it. There were some early Gentile religious leaders around 100 AD. Origen is one of them. Polycarp. Some other ones, Justin Martyr, who was later, they didn't like Jews. They just didn't. They were just anti-Semitic. They said some terrible things, and they worked to write and start to separate the faith from Judaism. But you can't say it was only Jewish. You tracking with me? So they started to write to separate, and you could read their writings to this day, and you go, oh, that's horrible. They just didn't like Jews. And there was a bunch of reasons for it, but they just didn't like Jews. And I'm using ishes on purpose because depending what point in time we're talking about, the story has a little bit of a shift. But around 270 AD-ish, Constantine, his mother, he's Roman leader, and his mom became one of the early believers. And back then in Rome, if you were a believer, you would be put to death. Constantine loved his mom. He saw some political opportunity to it. So he took the writings of those patriarchs and his own political ambitions, very important, his own political ambitions, and he called together a council. They put together a group, and they created the Council of Nicaea. And so often to this day, people look at the Council of Nicaea in churches, and they say, boy, that was the best thing ever. Look at the Nicaean Creed. Look at all these great things we got. But in the fine print, you know, the devil's in the details, right? In the fine print, Constantine, by doing this and his own political ambitions and all these other things, said it is illegal for Jews to come in to what was then called churches and worship what we know today, and they knew then, a Jewish rabbi named Yeshua. He made it illegal. And if they would do that without converting, it was never called converting before. When Yeshua lived in the earth, it was never a conversion. It was just people saying, yes, this is the way. This is the way. If we would go to Jerusalem today, we see all these different rabbis and they all wear different hats and ultra-Orthodox rabbis and everybody dresses like them. But they don't all agree with each other. Yeshua shows up and he says, I am the way. And then, well, he is the way. Imagine what if Yeshua wore today. We would dress like him today. If he wore a hat with the fur around the brim, we would wear a hat with the fur around the brim. That's what we would do. So it was very Jewish. So when Constantine said you can't be Jewish and come in here and follow a Jewish rabbi, it's crazy. You have to stop being Jewish. Yeshua never stopped. His Talmudim never stopped. The disciples, the first community, the first believers never stopped. It was Jew and Gentile. It was absolutely a crazy bend. When Constantine did that, from that point on, the church became the church. And it left out Judaism. And we look all through history and we see anti-Semitic church leader after anti-Semitic church leader after anti-Semitic church leader to the point where we get around 1000 AD and the Crusades come. And what were the Crusades? A holy quest to go kill the infidels in the land. Well, who are the infidels in the land? They're Jews. Because the early Crusades were before Muslims existed. Isn't that nuts? Muslims really aren't that old. Actually, they were when Muslims existed, it was just an immature group. The Muslim faith isn't very old. So the Crusade later, they turned political and they went through all this stuff. And this is just a really high level look. It's important to know by the time we get in our lifetimes, this is already a couple thousand years of being baked out. And you can study more stuff. There is a lot more historical evidence. You know that. I'm just sharing for a few minutes. Well, I was born. It covered a lot of ground there. And I'm saying that not about a year so much to say I recognize that we're at modern history now. Well, my kids would say ancient history, but you know what I mean. And we have to come to a point that's relevant for us here. This is a unbelievably hard message for me because half of this is very logical and I can process through my logic. Half of this for me is very heart. And I'm not the best at articulating my heart and I don't do it much anyway. So if you ask me later on, well, what does your heart tell you about this, Jim? I'm going to say, nah, I don't really want to talk about it. But just know, my heart part in this journey is probably much more important to me than my head part. Although my head part, I know that the Lord is sovereign. And he is good, and he is wise, and he is sovereign. You tracking with me? So 19, whatever, I was born, you were born. Is there anybody born after 2000 in year? A couple of you? All right, so 2000, some of you were born. And the world has come to what it's come to. There is a great separation between the Jewish community. The Jewish community has their thing. Church community has their thing. And they know about each other, but that's about it. And there's a lot of distrust from the Jewish community. There's a lot of crazy thinking in the church community about the Jewish community. Highly anti-Semitic, we know that. Without Martin Luther's quotes, Hitler would have had a hard time promoting the Holocaust. So we know the church leaders, they had anti-Semitic stuff baked in there. I'm not picking on Martin Luther. He's just a man. He was just really off on that topic. Really bad on that topic. But a lot of people were bad on that topic. Henry Ford was bad on that topic. Anyway, we come to this point in time. And my dad was in the Air Force. We moved around a lot as a family. Mom, dad, me, my sisters and brother came in the story later on. I mean, they're young. What do they know, you know? And we bumped around the country a little bit, and we stopped in Alaska. And my dad was the last person to come to faith in Alaska. And before then, it was my mom, and then after my mom, a year or so after my mom, it was me. And then after that, it was my dad. And Alaska was really a crazy time for us, the three of us. I can speak for them, and we've talked about this a lot. It was just a time where we saw a lot of miracles. I mean, eyeball seeing miracles where people are healed and things that were just life-changing. And it was very, very easy to know that God is sovereign because we saw stuff with our eyes, and he was changing the inside of us as well. And when we were there, we went to a church. There wasn't any messianic communities back then so much. The rebirth of the Messianic movement, we see early signs of it in America around 1890, 1892. A guy named Leopold Cohn in New York, a Jewish man with the name Cohn, right, in New York, launched this early, what turned into a Messianic ministry. In 1968, right after the Six-Day War, something happened in America. They made a movie about it called The Jesus People. Anybody see The Jesus People movie? It's kind of a flashback to hippie days. Just a bunch of people in America that gave their lives to Jesus. Well, in the Messianic community in 1968, that was also the recognized massive American relaunch of the Messianic movement. It started in Cincinnati, Ohio, and then Los Angeles, and then it kind of moved around from there. Well, we were living in Alaska, and there was no Messianic place, and the word Messianic wasn't even really a commonly used word. We just knew that if you're going to follow the Messiah, you went to a church. Although we had some shots across the bow, we had some sense that the Messianic movement was going. There's a band called Lamb. Sometimes we sing some of their songs. We remember Lamb in 1875. There was a time that a man named Jeff Kipp was talking to my dad, and he was a Jewish believer also. And I remember he and my dad and I were just standing there, and he was telling my dad, he said, "Frank, you're not going to believe it. It's crazy. There's these Hebrew Christians, man. You got to come and hear them. It's amazing. Hebrew Christians." Because the word Messiah believing and Messiah following wasn't used back then, it was Hebrew Christian. And I remember these kind of things. I remember we took a vacation, and I was a young teenager, and we had gone to Los Angeles as a family to see Disneyland. And there was a Messianic congregation that my dad wanted to go to, and it was the second oldest one in America after this 1968 relaunch. So he and I went on a Shabbat. It was a Friday night, Erev Shabbat. And I remember it was just kind of a mess. You know, they did everything. At the time, I only knew so much. I remember Hanukkah or Passover as a kid. And I remember in Anchorage visiting a temple that we got kicked out of. And my dad was asked not to come back to the Orthodox place. So I remember that stuff as a kid, that I knew the traditions that I knew. And I remember going to this place on Erev Shabbat, and they did a Torah processional. And some of you old-time Bethites have heard me share this story before, because you don't take the Torah out on the Shabbat. The Torah stays in on the Erev Shabbat. You take it out on the morning, but not the evening. You leave it in at night. And it's traditional. It's not biblical. And I remember they took it out, and they were so excited when the Torah came out. There was like I call it a conga line. It wasn't really a conga line. But there were so many people behind the Torah, and it's moving up and down, and they're like, yeah, they're wearing blue jeans, those heathens, and they're doing crazy things, but they were so excited to see the Torah come out, and they were just, it was so genuine. It was a catchy excitement. And so we go back to Alaska where we lived, and we go back to church, and we ended up coming to Milwaukee, of course, and we were here for a number of years. We moved here in 1981. We're here for a number of years, and my life goes on. I find a beautiful bride, and, you know, my siblings are in the picture, and, you know, life is life. And, I finished school. I finished, my university. I have a master's degree. I finished that, and I got some jobs, and I had a corporate day job, and I led, and we came here to plant a church. So Anchor Falls came out of that. And it was just a busy, busy time in life. And my dad would say the same thing, busy, busy, busy. He had a lot of things he was doing. He's always been a shaker, always looking for something else to do. And he was busy, busy. And one day this man, Jeff Kipp, the same one all those years earlier in Alaska, who said, "Hey, there's a Hebrew Christian group." He said, "I've got a friend named Asher in Trader. He's going to be speaking at the Wisconsin Governor's Prayer Breakfast. You should have him into your church and have him speak." It's a long story, but my dad had him do it. At first, it almost didn't happen, but later on, it did come to be. He spoke this night, and I remember I left my corporate job to drive to this evening service, and my dad was standing at the front door waiting for me with this guy, Asher. He's a Jewish guy, and I didn't know Asher. My dad doesn't wait for me ever, ever. He'll say, "I'm out. If you see me getting smaller, it's because I'm walking away." I mean, my dad doesn't wait. But this particular night, he was waiting at the front door of our building, our old building on Capitol. And with him is this guy who I know is Asher. And we walk in, and my dad looks, and he said, this is how he pointed me. "We got to go to your office right now." Okay. Not what I expected. So we go to my office, we sit down, and my dad said, he looks at Asher, he said, "Asher, tell him what you told me." Okay. Asher said, "All right." Now remember, I don't know Asher. I've never met Asher. I don't know anything about Asher. And he said, why aren't you in the Messianic movement? Hey, man. And I thought, it's kind of a, you know, almost a little personal. You're in this church building, so clearly we got that going on. And I have a day job, and I have a family, and I'm pretty busy. Now, I'd known about the Messianic, and at this point, it's called Messianic. Like I told you, I'd been around it before. And I said, "Well, I'm pretty busy." And he said, "Wait, I see you have a healthy congregation here. And I talked to some of your people, and it's really it's a healthy community of believers." And he said, "You know, what you brought into the community, the Messianic community needs. The Messianic community needs you." And I don't know what happened, I couldn't put, if you put a gun to my head and said, tell me what exactly went on. And I can't tell you. I can't tell you because it was a heart thing. Something
broke.
I just thought, yeah. Now it's strange for me. I mean, I can't, I still can't tell you, but something broke and I was never the same, ever. And you know, it's funny to me because my family is a Jewish family. You know, the Sussler family is a Jewish family, and I think, and I mean, I know Jewish stuff, you know. Why not? Why wasn't a part of it? So I went back, and my dad was on his own quest because he has his own story. And he something clacked in him, you know. For him, it was a different kind of journey, but something happened in him, and he thought, "Yeah, I got to do something Messianic community." I go home to my wife, and I say, "You're not going to believe this story. This guy Asher came out of nowhere. He asked me this question: Why aren't you in the movement?" And I said, "I don't know. I don't know." You know. And she looks at me. She said, "Are you going to be?" And I said, "Yes, I think I am." And I don't know what, I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know. Then do I go, do I buy a book? What is it? What do I do? Do I pick up a phone and call somebody? So my dad goes on his quest and I'm on my quest. My quest is very different than my dad's. My dad's is to find out what's going on across America. He's got his whole story. My quest is, what is my heart? Boy, I don't know. And like I said, I can't share all my heart stuff with you. But it was a big deal for me. And I started to look at the scriptures, really look at them. My dad would come back and he would talk to me from his journeys, from his books. And I started doing my own thing. And I do my heart quest. And I read some of my own books. And I talk to some of my own people. And I have my own experiences to pull from. But I know the Lord's doing something in me because I can't explain it. You know, when the Lord's doing something in you, most of the time, we don't know what's going on. But sometimes we know what's going on and we can't explain it. So here's the scriptures I came across, and I'm going to go through them very fast, but I want you to see how we became Irgun Kodesh. Leviticus 23, Adonai spoke to Moses saying, speak to Bnei Israel, the children of Israel, and tell them these are the appointed Moedim of Adonai, the appointments, the convocations of the Lord, which you are to proclaim to be holy convocations, my Moedim, my appointments, God says. These are my appointments. And then he lists these long, the groups of what we know are the high holy days, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Shavuot. And he, so he lists them. He said, these are mine. God said, these are mine. And I know because I at this point had actually celebrated some of them. I didn't know anything about Shavuot, but I sure knew about Pesach and I knew about some of these other things. And I thought, yeah, they're the Lord's appointments. And these other references here are where the Lord says, hey, Abram, I'm giving your seed, you know, you see a genetic call there. I'm giving your seed this land forever. Do you know it doesn't matter who lives in the land? Do you know who the land always belongs to? Abraham's seed, because God said. It doesn't matter if Palestinians live on it. It doesn't matter if Germans live on it or French or Irish. God gave it to Abraham's seed. And I know this. And I know that the blessing goes through Abraham and then Isaac and then Jacob forever. The covenant is forever. The covenant that we know later is for all nations forever. It has to, it's going to be connected to Abraham and his seed, what we would call Israel today and Jewish community today forever. There's no stop to it. I know this in my head. I know this verse. I know this, Ezekiel 37. And he said to me, God, Hashem himself has said to Ezekiel, son of man, can these bones live? After you've taken him in a vision to a valley of bones, can these bones live? And I like his response, said, Adonai Elohim, you know, why are you asking me this? Verse said, then he, God said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried up, our hope is lost, and we are cut off by ourselves. You know what churches do with this verse a lot? They read, they say, the bones are how I feel. I feel weary. I have weary bones. But that passage actually is about Israel. We read on, therefore prophesy and say to them that thus says Adonai Elohim, behold, I will open your graves. I will bring you up out of your graves, my people. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. The Aliyah will happen. I will make Aliyah occur. And you will know that I am Adonai when I have opened your graves and brought you up out of your graves. My people, I will put my ruach, my spirit on you, in you, and you will live. I will place you in your old land. Then you will know that I, Adonai, have spoken, and that it is I have done it, for it is a declaration of Adonai. 1948, I knew in 1948 that Israel was reestablished as a country. I knew that. And I knew that there wasn't an army that did it. It wasn't any coercion. It wasn't finances. It wasn't anything. But a massive miracle. There's no story, but a miracle story to look at the creation of Israel. And I knew that God had promised it. Because of God's promises, God kept his word to Abraham and Ezekiel. I knew this passage, Romans 11. I say then that they did not stumble as to fall. He's talking about the Jewish community here. May it never be, but by their false step, salvation has come to the Gentiles to provoke Israel to jealousy. This is what he's saying. He's saying, look, not all Jews at the time in 30 AD, 35, 40 AD, not all Jews in Israel understood, or in Jerusalem, because it's always just Jerusalem, understood that Yeshua was for them at that time. But that's okay, because it was prophesied. And Deuteronomy 32 is one of the areas. Here, I'm going to point out another couple areas. We see connections to it in Daniel 8, in Isaiah 59, Isaiah 27, Jeremiah 31. I put those in there because I wanted you to see that when we look in the New Covenant, we're seeing fulfillment of the prophecies in the Old. And when Paul says and I knew this, when the Jewish community, I'm going to say Jim words, not Paul's words, when the Jewish community in Israel, when they see that Gentiles are following a very Jewish Messiah, that's going to make them jealous. Instead, what's happened is the church has gone so far away. They broke it. They made it anti-Semitic. They made it like an us or them mentality. It was never an us or them mentality. When they did that and they broke it so far away, the Jewish community doesn't even know that churches are technically following the Jewish rabbi, because they don't give any credit to the Jewish rabbi. I knew this passage, Luke 13. Look to your house. Look, your house is left you desolate. For I tell you, you will never see me again until you say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So what is Yeshua saying? This is Yeshua talking. He's saying, look, I'm telling you the prophecy from Psalm 118. I'm telling you that I'm going to come back, but I'm not going to come back. And this is really a part of a bigger passage. I'm not going to come back until Israel says, not the Methodist Church, not the Lutheran church, not the Catholic church, not the Charismatic church, not the Pentecostal church, not the Baptist church, not the, till Israel says, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. That is a phrase to this day in the Jewish community to call in Messiah. So they know it's a known thing. He comes back when Israel declares it. And I know this. Finally, Zechariah 14. Then all the survivors from all nations, this prophecy has not been fulfilled yet. This cannot be fulfilled until Mashiach, until Messiah comes back. Then all survivors from all nations that attack Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the king, Adonai Tzevaot, Lord of Hosts, and to celebrate Sukkot, Feast of Tabernacles. Furthermore, if any of the nations on earth do not go up to Jerusalem, they will to worship the king, Adonai Tzevaot, they will have no rain. The Lord's coming back. He's going to make everybody on earth, whether they're a Jew or Gentile. It's not going to be a problem for Jews, because they're going to be the ones to call on him to come back. But the Gentile nations on the world, when he comes back, there's going to be a worldwide Sukkot celebration. It's going to happen in Germany, in France, in Guatemala, Argentina, South Africa, Latvia. It's going to happen everywhere. It's prophesy. It's going to happen. But it's going to happen once the Messiah comes back. The Messiah is not going to come back until Israel says, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And Israel's not going to call on the Lord until the time of Gentiles to get the word out about following a Jewish rabbi happens. How's that for a story? So what I soaked on after that guy Asher was here, and my heart was really kind of wrecked, you know, And I know these verses, and there's other verses too. We can go on and on and on and on with verses. He said everything was supposed to happen. I thought, man, I really got to do something. And my dad, I was talking to him one day after this, it was before Beth Messiah, and he said, think about starting a messianic congregation. What do you think? That is as right as rain. We know this. We know these verses. Let's do it the right way. So Beth Messiah came. I remember he brought this up to the elders of our sister congregation. Remember, Beth wasn't here at the time. And he did a very good job walking them through, because at first they just kind of looked at him. What? Because their hearts weren't impacted like this. I could take this story. I could tell somebody who's been in a church their whole life, and they're going to go, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. And I could say, but didn't you just see the scriptures? Yeah, but I don't know what you're talking about. I could go over here to somebody in a synagogue, a shul, whatever, temple, and I could show them the same passages just from the Tanakh, just from the Old Testament. And they'll say, I don't know what you're talking about. But with the elders, they really got behind them. They got behind us. And they said, okay, do it. Do it. You start it. You do it. Well, Beth Messiah started in 2005. This is our 20th year, almost our anniversary, not quite, almost. And Beth Messiah was, their sister congregation was wonderful. They gave us money to buy things. We have a Torah. I got to tell you, it's a big deal. I don't know if you know the replacement value of a Torah, but they're going for, they started about 75 grand. Torah is, without a Torah, how you have a synagogue, a shul, temple, congregation like ours, I don't know how you do it. So we have a Torah and we have other things too. So they gave us money, seed money to start. They gave us the building, but it was always their building. And we were trying to figure it out. What do we do? So we just saved money. And we save money, we save money. And my dad went rabbi emeritus about 9 or 10 years ago. And I stepped in. I left my corporate job to come and do this. And we still had a little bit of an us and them mentality, because the property was really owned by our sister congregation. And we were just kind of freeloaders. Not really, but you know what I mean, you know. And we have our own elders here, our own board here, and we have our own ministries here, we have our own vision here. We are entirely separate. So it's an odd thing to come in here and go, well, yeah, it's nice that we can use it. You know, it's nice, but it just, you know, it felt like you're using somebody else's tools or somebody else's fishing pole or somebody else's toothbrush, you know? I know it. I know it. You know what I mean. So it just didn't make sense. In the business world, I worked a lot in a profession called organizational design. And it's a consulting kind of work that helps realign and organizations for greater efficiency or whatever. And I came back and I was talking to my dad and I kept looking at this and I kept looking. I don't know about this. It just doesn't make sense that we're using this kind of layout. It just doesn't. And my dad said, what do you want to do? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. And so we decided, and ultimately through this and a lot of conversations, the elders here at Beth and the elders at our sister congregation, Anchor, agreed to something to create a new organization called Ergun Kodesh, to recognize that the vision of Beth Messiah is never, ever going to be the same as the vision of Anchor Falls. The elders are two groups. The money is two groups. But we need to share the physical stuff that we have. So how do we do it? That's where we created an organization called Ergun Kodesh, our holy assembly. And all of the assets that our sister congregation had, they said, it's now yours too. And we had the paperwork changed. So Beth Messiah is full on invested. And all the money that we had, we threw into purchasing this building. This building became our building. These are our chairs. It's our microphone. Our coffee stains in the hallway. You know what I mean? Became ours. It's the strangest thing ever. It's also the most wonderful thing ever because it's so special. For me, the heart piece is the most special part for me. I think what we have here, Jews, Gentiles, young, used to be young, wherever we're at, I think this is what heaven is going to look like. I think this is a holy assembly. I think it's going to be a smattering of everything we can imagine, age-wise and looks-wise. It always travels through the Jewish roots. The whole Bible is a Jewish book. The New Covenant, the New Testament, was not written for Gentiles. The New Testament shows us how the Old Testament was fulfilled and how to walk it out with Messiah. It was never to replace the old. It was always fulfillment and how to walk it out with Messiah. It's not an added-on thing. There's no temple. Our sacrifice lamb is Yeshua. How do we walk it out? That's Beth Messiah! I know by the nature of us existing here in Milwaukee, we're not fully understood by churches or all the synagogues around us. But we exist to tell them. Sometimes I get people who are mad at me. I can tell you some good stories of people who are mad at me. I met a rabbi from a synagogue. Right in the middle of the handshake, he finds out where I'm from, and he pulls his hand out, and he turns his shoulder on me. So I grab his shoulder. I did this. I really did this. And I pulled him back around to face me, and I picked his hand up again, and I finished the handshake. And I said, "It's really nice to meet you." I can tell you the story of a pastor. I was at a church event. I was sitting there. And anytime I tell people about Beth Messiah, it doesn't matter where they're from, religiously, they stop and they go, "Huh." And so one guy, young guy is sitting next to me. I'm talking to a group of people, and this guy's sitting next to me, and he's like, "That's amazing. That's amazing. I'm a youth leader at this church," whatever, XYZ church. It's a decent-sized church. He goes, "I can't believe that. I think that's this amazing story. Let me tell my pastor." So he taps his pastor's shoulder, and the pastor says, "This guy's from Beth Messiah, this Messianic Jewish community. This is amazing." And the pastor said, "Don't talk to him anymore." Hey, anti-Semite. You follow a Jewish rabbi, man. You better figure yourself out real fast. Because I can't. You know what I'm talking about? I've worked with people in the corporate world. One lady found out, I was coaching her. I was a professional coach, assigned her. And she was well thought of, a high-level employee. And that's why I was helping her get better. And she said, I'll be on vacation next week. Where are you going? Israel. She said, "Why are you going to Israel?" "I love Israel. If I could live there, I would live there. I would die there. If the Israeli army would give me a gun, I would sit in the way back and shoot people at a distance. Or I'll carry the water buckets if they're in a fight. I don't care. Let the old man do what the old man can do, you know?" And I'm talking to her. And she never talked to me again. She stopped showing up for all her counseling sessions. And in corporate terminology, this is how I would say it, that had an adverse impact on her career. She wanted nothing to do with me. We could go stories all day long, but that's why we're here. To carry the story of the great Jewish rabbi, to talk about something that's so old religiously, it predates churches. My dad has said many, many times, Messianic Judaism is older than Christianity. It's true. It's not putting Christianity down, but Christianity can't remember. They can't forget its roots. You know, sometimes I forget my car keys. That's one thing. But we can't forget our roots. We can't forget the Messiah is going to come back. He's coming back as a Jewish man, a Jewish Messiah. He's not coming back as a pope. I'm not putting the pope down. I'm sure he's a lovely fellow. I'm just saying who we worship, the one we follow. Are you with me? That's why we're Irgun Kodesh. There's way more details. There's also something in the world called time. We've run out. There are more details. If you want to hear more of them, ask my dad or my mom, my wife. Ask anybody who's been here for a long time. They'll just be able to add more over time. We do want to impact the Jewish community. We want to impact the church community. Our mission, though, is Jewish community. We follow a Jewish rabbi. That's why we do what we do. If you have more questions about what it is to follow a Jewish rabbi, there's going to be two men here with lanyards. In fact, I'm going to give them lanyards after service. All this time I've said they have lanyards. They don't have lanyards. Today they're getting lanyards. If you want to know more about what it is to follow a Jewish rabbi, it's literally a prayer. You say it, you believe it, you say it, and you do it. You follow him. That's it. Boom. Just like that, they will pray with you. You don't have to know their name. Or you may have known them for 10 years. I've been coming here all this time and never once talked to them. Do it today. If you don't want to talk to them, talk to me. You don't want to talk to me, talk to my dad. You don't want to talk to my dad, talk to the person that brought you. You don't like the person that brought you, you got to talk to somebody. But the scriptures say we believe it, we have to say it to somebody. We have to confess it. And then we do it. Those three steps. Amen? Ergun Kodesh, please stand up. Let's close with a word of prayer. Thank you, Lord, for your goodness in our lives, God. It is way more than we deserve. The story of why we're here, Lord, is your story. It's your work. 2,000 years, Lord, to know that there's Beth Messiah and there's places popping up all over the world now. It's not an accident with the timing. It's just the craziest thing, Lord. Crazy. Thank you for calling us here today. Thank you for bringing us to being a part of your work. We pray that we would always be sensitive to your leadership, always be sensitive to the accuracy of your word, that we can do it right. Thank you for this house. B'Shem Yeshua. Amen. Yevarech Adonai. Voyishmerecha, Ye'er Adonai Panav Aliecha V'yunecha, Yesei Adonai Panav Aliecha V'yaseim Lacha Shalom. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace.